fog. Best of the sunshine across eastern and southern Scotland, but the showers will develop more widely as the day goes on across northern and western areas. Still snow as the hills. So tomorrow night, or sorry, the coming night, it'll be wet across the southern half of Wales and southwest of England as well, particularly with severe gales potentially for northern Scotland. And the cold continues in the north through the weekend. In the south, we'll see some rain from time to time. Now back to Alice.
Thanks, Helen. Now, Penelope Wilton reads the next of our abridged extracts from Charles Dickens' A Life by Claire Tomalin. We join Dickens when he's 44. He continues to work at a feverish pitch, and his 8 children and other family members continue to tax his time and his purse. Meanwhile, he still finds opportunities to enjoy the company of close friends and his homes in Kent and London. Yet as 1857 approaches, great change looms.
Apart from the progress of Little Dorrit, Dickens' major preoccupation was now the preparations for a play to be performed at Tavistock House on his son Charlie's 20th birthday. It was a melodrama written by Wilkie Collins called The Frozen Deep, and the inspiration came from Sir John Franklin's expedition of 1845 to find the Northwest Passage. Dickens immediately saw himself in the role of the sacrificial hero, Richard Wardour, one of a group of polar explorers that includes the man who has won the heart of Clara, the woman he loves, away from him. In truth, the plot is preposterous, and the writing hardly better, but Victorian taste was broad, and Dickens's performance, by all accounts, outstanding. In October 1856, he memorised all his lines for The Frozen Deep during one 20-mile walk through Finchley, Neasden and Wilsdon. His beard had grown impressively, giving him a rakish look. His wife Catherine went to stay with the Macready family while Tavistock House was filled with joiners and a 30-foot-long stage constructed. Critics from several papers, including The Times, came and wrote glowing notices. All too quickly, the 4 performances were over. Dickens reported, "It has been the talk of all London for these 3 weeks, and now it is a mere chaos of scaffolding, ladders, beams, canvas, paint pots, sawdust, artificial snow, gas pipes, and ghastliness. I have taken such pains with it these 10 weeks that I feel now shipwrecked." There were other distractions. Dickens' 45th birthday was celebrated, and a few days later he went to his house at Gad's Hill to take formal possession. It stood on the hilltop associated with Falstaff, with fine views over the Kentish countryside. Its value to him was in something greater than bricks, mortar and plumbing. It was the fulfilment of his childhood ambition, and another proof that the vulnerable small boy of 1820 could achieve whatever he set out to do. In June, he heard of the death of his friend Douglas Jerrold, and immediately set about schemes to raise money for his widow and children. Here was his chance to revive The Frozen Deep. Dickens also decided to give 2 paid public readings, the first ever, of A Christmas Carol. They were greeted with tumultuous enthusiasm by an audience of 2,000. Then came a request to take The Frozen Deep and a farce called Uncle John to Manchester. Given the hall seated an audience of 4,000, it would be necessary to employ trained actresses. Mrs. Ternan and 2 of her daughters, Maria and Nellie, had been recommended, and Dickens took to both sisters and their mother immediately. Nellie, fair and blue-eyed, would play opposite Dickens in Uncle John. On the 20th of August, he set off to Manchester with a large family party, including Catherine. He was in such good spirits that he had everyone playing games on the train. There was no corridor, and conundrums were passed on sticks and umbrellas through the windows from carriage to carriage, with much laughter and shouting against the wind. His elation continued, and in Manchester he gave his finest performances yet. Back at Gad's Hill, he wrote an account of his unsettled state of mind. "I feel as if the scaling of all the mountains in Switzerland, or the doing of any wild thing until I dropped, would be but a slight relief. He'd found out that Mrs. Ternan and her daughters were going to be in Doncaster to perform, and he'd once booked rooms there. Dickens's meeting with the Ternan family in August 1857 led to changes in every aspect of his life. The wing of a butterfly flapped, and a whole weather system was unsettled. The storm blew up and broke with his separation from Catherine. In the wake of this, friendships were severed, publishers dismissed. There were no more family holidays. His connection with the home at Shepherd's Bush, over which he had presided with dedication for a decade, ceased. Another great change was brought about by his decision to take up a second career as a professional reader. The readings gave him the extra income he needed in order to finance a growing number of dependents, the Ternans among them. His relations with the public changed too, because the Dickens heard at the readings was not quite the same as Dickens read on the page. He made his scripts from only a few of his novels and stories, dramatizing them with much redrafting, condensing and cutting, and many divergences. The readings gave him reassurance that he was loved. What did Dickens hope for when he went to Doncaster to meet the Ternans? To revive some of the intense emotion of the Manchester performances? To make closer bonds of friendship with the family? And something more, he wanted Nellie, small, graceful and pretty as she was. She was 18 years old. He thought he might have her, as his letters make clear. Whatever took place in Doncaster, there was no seduction. Friendship was established, and with that he returned to Tavistock House, excited and tormented. On the 11th of October, he instructed Catherine's maid Anne to have a partition put up, making a separation between his wife's bedroom and a dressing room where he would now sleep alone. In the ardour of his new love for Nellie, he wanted to be pure as a boy again. Pure as a boy was impossible. Instead, the darkest part of his character was summoned up. He was ready to be cruel to his defenceless wife. A raging anger broke out at any opposition to his wishes. He had lost his judgment. The spectacle of a man famous for his goodness and his attachment to domestic virtues suddenly losing his moral compass is dismaying. It would have been easier, as well as pleasanter for him, had Nellie fallen into his arms instead of requiring him to play out a charade of platonic friendship. A naughty girl could have made him happy. As it was, she remained unattainable, although elated by his attentions, and he yearned for her and suffered. He asked Forster to act for him in negotiations with Catherine over a legal separation. In May 1858, Dickens composed a letter about the separation, which in August appeared in print. It presented the marriage as having been unhappy for many years, and that Mrs. Dickens herself had often suggested a separation and felt herself unfit for the life she had to lead as my wife, and that she would be better far away. These remarks sound like ones made during a quarrel. They are the sort of words a miserable wife might use, hoping to bring her husband to treat her more kindly. The letter goes on to boast of Dickens's generosity in making the terms of the separation. Then it speaks of how two wicked persons have coupled with this separation the name of a young lady for whom I have a great attachment and regard. I will not repeat her name. I honour it too much. Upon my soul and honour, there is not on this earth a more virtuous and spotless creature than this young lady. This was, of course, Nellie. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, appalled, wrote, "What a crime for a man to use his genius as a cudgel against his near kin, taking advantage of his hold with the public to turn public opinion against her. I call it dreadful." Dickens began his first provincial tour of 85 readings at the beginning of August. The world was now divided for Dickens between those who supported him through his separation, or at least said nothing, and his enemies. In this situation, the applause and praise received at readings became increasingly important as a balm to his wounds, allowing him to believe in his own goodness. The year ended, and 1859 began with several readings in London of A Christmas Carol. Forster made up for his earlier disapproval with praise. "You read in a masterly way last night. Indeed, I was immensely moved." Then he had to go into battle on hearing that Dickens was thinking of letting Tavistock House to the Ternan family. Dickens allowed himself to be persuaded. He had another argument with Forster over the naming of his new weekly magazine. Dickens wanted to call it Household Harmony. Forster suggested the words might raise a few eyebrows in view of the recent events. Dickens gave in again. As for Dickens the novelist, he gave his imagination a shake and produced at high speed and in weekly instalments two novels in 2.5 years, A Tale of Two Cities and Great Expectations. Begun in October 1860, Great Expectations comes out of a deep place in Dickens's imagination. It is a great book, delicate and frightening, funny, sorrowful, mysterious. It is placed, like so many of his books, in the period of his own childhood and youth, and set in home territory for him, the Kentish marshlands and Rochester and the London of the law courts. The orphan boy encounters monsters. Magwitch, Orlick, Miss Havisham, Jaggers, and he can't tell which threatens and which favours him. His innocence becomes tarnished by money and what it seems to promise. He neglects the good spirits who protect him, Joe the blacksmith and Biddy the schoolteacher, and is lured by Estella, a belle dame sans merci. Pip's story is one of failure. Failure to understand what is happening to him, failure to win the girl he loves, failure to save his benefactor, failure to make anything of himself. He just redeems himself morally, and that is enough after all he has seen. In 1862, the Russian novelist Dostoevsky, an admirer of Dickens' work, he had read the Pickwick Papers and David Copperfield in prison, visited him. Years later, he wrote a remarkable account of their conversation. "He told me that all the good simple people in his novels are what he wanted to have been, and his villains were what he was, or rather, what he found in himself. His cruelty, his attacks of causeless enmity towards those who were helpless and looked to him for comfort, his shrinking from those whom he ought to love, being used up in what he wrote. There were two people in him, he told me, one who feels as he ought to feel, and one who feels the opposite. From the one who feels the opposite, I make my evil characters. From the one who feels as a man ought to feel, I try to live my life." "Only two people?" I asked. This is an amazing report. If Dostoevsky remembered correctly, it must be Dickens's most profound statement about his inner life and his awareness of his own cruelty and bad behaviour. It's as though, with Dostoevsky, he could drop the appearance of perfect virtue he felt he had to keep up before the English public. It also suggests that he was aware of drawing his evil characters from a part of himself that he disapproved of, and yet could not control.
And at the same time tomorrow, Penelope Wilton continues to read from Charles Dickens' A Life by Claire Tomalin. The abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. Coming up next, it's the shipping forecast, but first to take us there, it's Sailing By. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday, the 2nd of December. There are warnings of gales in Viking, north at Cirra, south at Cirra, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger, Biscay, Fitzroy, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low white, 1004, expected Estonia, 989 by 1800 Friday. Low, southeast Iceland, 989, losing its identity by the same time. New low expected southeast Iceland 962 by that time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Cirra, south at Cirra. Northwesterly 5 or 6, backing southerly 6 to gale 8 later. Wintry showers, rain later, good, occasionally moderate. Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger.